Hello. Ah, now that I've got your attention, I'd like a quick word about how Cambridge 105 Radio is funded. Our job is to give a voice to those groups who may not otherwise be heard. That may be our support for local music or the charity of the month. You're wanting to know how you can help, aren't you? Well, you can support our advertisers. And when you use their services, say you heard about them on Cambridge 105 Radio. And you can make a donation. It all goes towards our upkeep. We're eco-friendly, but we do have a bit of an electricity bill. Visit cambridge105.co.uk and click on the donate button. And thank you for listening. On FM, digital and your mobile, Cambridge 105 Radio.
Good afternoon, and on the weekend that we learnt that 50% of the food brought in the UK is super processed, we bring you the real thing, flavour, with news and views of real food and drink in Cambridge. We're live in the studio, taking over the mic from Tony Barnfield, we being me, Matt Bentman, and...
me, Alan Alder. And today, a local independent fights back after suffering heavy losses in a burglary. Meanwhile, a new cafe comes to Hobson Street, and as the growing season beckons, we find out from Dave Fox of Trumpington Allotments about planning your fruit and vegetable plots. And we hear from Dan Warner of Thomas Etty Seeds about some heritage seeds you can sow with the promise of fruit and veg with real flavour.
We've a feature on wines from the Burgundy region of France, and of course at the end of the programme we'll have the Cambridge food and drink news.
But first, just in case you'd missed this, La Latina Bustoranti, the double-decker bus on the Cambridge retail park serving South American cuisine, has been burgled for the third time. The losses from this one break-in amount to over £8,000. But when the equipment which provides your entire income is stolen, how do you get back on your feet? I went to talk to owners Catalina and Nelson about the burglary and the help the people of Cambridge have given. Tell me how you discovered that you'd been burgled for a third and most serious time.
Well, the usual. We got a phone call from the security office saying we've got some bad news. They've broken into your bus again. So, you know, we were still getting ready. We had just dropped off our kids from school. And we had to come running to clean everything up. Clean off the nice thieves that did whatever they had to do.
So it happened overnight?
Yes, according to the CCTV, it was about just gone 10:30, so which is still early because across the road the shops were still open. There's still cars, there's still people, cyclists, and they are considered to be broad daylight because usually thieves operate at a very late hour.
Yeah, and very visible from the road as well. They broke in on the roadside, didn't they?
Yes, they did, and if you come over the bridge, you can clearly see there's something going on, you know. Yeah. And obviously, I know it's not down to them to call the police, but they do it, and there's no consequences, I think.
Yes, and the police presumably are following it up, are they?
Well, the police were quick to come. The last time they were here, within the hour, forensics, they did fingerprints and footprints and everything they had in there. Obviously, they haven't come back to us with a result, with an answer.
Yeah. Right, and what did you lose? Equipment, money?
Well, money, we don't leave any money inside the bus, but equipment-wise, well, they took everything from our kitchen, from...
But they took everything, the food processor, the blender, everything?
Knives, aprons, plates, food we had in the storage. They emptied our fridge. And in the process, they threw everything everywhere because there was someone that commented saying our fridges were dirty, when in reality the thieves, well, they didn't clean after themselves.
Yeah.
So they made a big mess, but they took all the drinks we had. We had stocks of flour, everything we need to cook, everything we need to use. And the day before, I went shopping and I spent £300 in meat and chicken, which is in the fridge, so they've had a feast at our expense, you know.
Yeah.
They stole a lot of things from us, but one of the things they stole which had a lot of value was a little statue of Lady of Fatima, which was a fridge magnet given to me by my grandmother a week before she passed away, and she said, when I go, this will look after you, so look after it. And if you're listening, if you took it, please bring it back, because I really want it. I want it back. Thank you.
So you've got the losses incurred by that, but also by having to stop trading.
Well, it's loss of earnings because this is our full-time job for me and my wife. We're self-employed. We've created a job for ourselves, and we do well when other people don't come and disturb us like this.
You've got a lot of supporters, Catalina, I know. You've been selling cakes to try and raise money to sort of get yourself back on your feet. How's the cake sales gone?
It was amazing. It was over the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, we received lots of donations from the community, from the other foodies, all the support from them in social media helping us to spread the word about the cake sale. The cake sale was an absolute success. We managed to raise £1,574,
really?
Which is amazing.
I must say, the cakes were pretty amazing as well.
Yes.
I mean, I bought several of them and they were stunningly good. So you got some very good people baking the cakes for you.
We do, absolutely. Yeah, the cake was amazing. We have lovely contributions from afternoon teas, from Bridge at Cambridge. We sell their cakes like hot ones, yeah, as long as our cakes as well. We have friends baking for us. Everybody contributes, and obviously lots of people come and buy a cake, a piece of cake and coffee, and we all feel the support of them.
So does that make you feel better, Nelson? Do you feel?
Well, you know, we feel loved in a sense, because when you're feeling down. What can I say? When to see everybody come and support us like that was a great feeling for us, because you know we didn't know what to expect.
You don't know how valued you are sometimes, do you? Until until you're in a crisis and people rally around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's amazing to see all the community getting together to help us. It's overwhelming for us as well. For example, the thing they took, some things that are very difficult to us to get. So, for example, we import like cornflour. It's a special cornflour that we use to make our empanadas and arepas, and it's very difficult to get it here. Mm-hmm. We were as well very grateful with the guys, the Venezuelan couple. They do the arepa stations on the Cambridge market. They even donate a box of that flour because they know how valuable that flour is. That is so great to see from them as well. Yes. So we're very grateful for them.
So in the near future, what's going to happen? Are you going to be able to get the business back on its feet immediately, or do you need to raise some more money through cake sales or other means?
Well, we have to be open as soon as possible, because as Nelson said, this is the full-time job for both of us. Mm. So we cannot afford to be closed for long, because we are losing a lot of money on top of that. So I don't know how. We need to be open again very, very soon. Mm. Obviously, with the money we raised over the weekend, we're going to buy all the kitchen essentials for us to be able to cook again. But
yeah,
then again,
not cheap to buy.
Exactly. We cannot buy, you know, in the supermarket, this kind of thing. We have to use especially catering equipment. We have to follow the food hygiene color code thing, so that are more expensive to buy. So hopefully we're going to be back on business over the weekend. But still, we need to, obviously, we lost more than that. So we need to raise a little bit more, because we need to, you know, buy more security cameras, you know, more security alarms, yeah, to make the bus more safe, yeah, to prevent this happening again.
Nelson, I was going to ask you about security. So you think the answer is to try and get more cameras?
Well, I'll be connecting some more cameras tomorrow, but I'm putting some, what do you call, shutters on the windows. So, you know, that was the last thing I wanted to do, because that would take out all the beauty from yeah, everything we had. So I've talked to the artist that did the painting outside to come and repaint the shutters, so when we put them down you still have the beautiful graffiti. Well, by the way, he's my cousin, so hopefully he'll come and do that for us again.
Yes, he should rally round, shouldn't he? Right, well, let's hope you get up and running as soon as you say you are. And I'm sure, and if you need any help, I'm sure our listeners would be very pleased to help.
Thank you, Alan. Yeah, I just wanted to add them. Yeah, I'm going to make the post on social media about the reopening, and we thank you everybody who helped us. Thank you for having us again, and hopefully we can cook again for all of you in the future.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
While the good news is that Nelson and Catalina have managed to get enough funds to get going again, but there is still help that we can give. Obviously, one is visiting them. They're alongside the home-based garden centre in the Cambridge Retail Park. That's close to the roundabout on Coldham's Lane by the Beehive Centre.
And another way of helping is by donating. They're still trying to raise £2,500. You can help by going to the Just Giving website, typing in La Latina Bustamante, and making a donation. And it, I've really realised that actually I haven't done that yet, so I will get on with it.
And a third way is letting the police know if you saw anything suspicious at about 10:30 on the night of the 22nd of January. Perhaps you were going along Coldham's Lane or you saw people pushing a trolley along Newmarket Road. Phone 101 and quote reference CF004-122-011 or just mention La Latina Bustamante.
Yeah. Anyway, let's hope we can help Catalina and Nelson get back on their feet. And we have heard from Catalina this morning and that they had hoped to reopen today, but they're not. Nelson is fitting metal shutters, so they will now reopen on Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, 7th of February, from 12 noon until 7 p.m, and we wish them well.
Yeah, and there have been other break-ins recently too. The Cambridge Fruit Company had two of its vans broken into during the week, so we really need to be vigilant in these times of increasing crime.
Yes, we do. But now, something a little more cheerful. Well, a lot more cheerful. The cafe at Wysing Arts Centre built up a good following and a lot of positive comments were made about it. When its lease ended, it happened to coincide with the closure of Sticky Beaks in Hobson Street here in Cambridge. Owner Wendy Slade decided against renewing her lease and moved into Cambridge instead, taking over from Sticky Beaks. And today is the first official day for Abantu in Hobson Street, and I spoke with Wendy earlier in the week. Wendy, why the move from Wysing to Cambridge?
Well, I've been in Bourne for a very long time now, 12 years, and I've always wanted to migrate to Cambridge. And when this opportunity arose, and it was a perfect fit, and although I love being in the village, it was time I'd done my sort of bit of village work. It was time for me to sort of grow, shall I say, and come into Cambridge. I always wanted to be in Cambridge, so that's why I'm now here.
What sort of food will you be selling? You got cakes or meals? What sort of?
Yeah, we're selling a couple of hot dishes. First menu, we've got the South African babuati on the menu. We've got a lovely lasagna made out of wild mushrooms and spinach. We have got Romano's pork pies and some scotch eggs. And then we're going to have a big salad counter, 4 or 5 count salads each day, so that you can add it to whatever you're having. Soups of the day, cakes all made here, from vegan all the way through to normal cakes. So quite a variety of a menu. Plus, we're working with Stir Bakery, getting some of their bread and rolls and sourdough in here, which is going to be really lots of fun.
And drinks, I mean, obviously coffee. Where are you getting your coffee from?
I have got my coffee from a fair trade coffee from Matthew Algy for the last 7 years, as long as I've really been open as a coffee shop, and we use their coffee machine as well. So it's a very ethical company, and they're based up in Scotland. I've bought my coffee machine across, and I will continue to always use Matthew Aldi coffee. I use their teas as well, which is loose leaf tea.
And free hot chocolate, I have heard mentioned.
Free hot chocolate. I don't know if you remember a craze that went over in London about last summer, and it was called Freak Milkshakes, where you went, and we did that last summer at Wysing, where you just made a milkshake and you topped it with whatever you could, you know, from Mars bars to whatever. And so we took that into the Freak Shake. My first time, we call the Freak Chocolates because of the Freak Shakes. My first time seeing it was down in Cornwall, Poldhu Beach, actually. So I saw them having fun with hot chocolate there. So we thought, well, if we can do Freak Shakes, we can do Freak hot chocolate. So it's just a bit of fun when we can.
So that's going to continue, is it?
I think so. We will bring chocolate in once the staff have got. I don't want to chuck Sticky Beak staff into making free hot chocolates the moment they open. But we do. We just buy some fun things at the supermarket and make free hot chocolates.
Okay. And alcohol, have you got a license?
We do. We haven't done the process yet of going on courses and that, but we will continue to do that a little later. But my priority was to get open. So wine and beer will come later.
And what will the hours of opening be?
When we open now, it will be 8:30 or 5.
Yeah.
But if we're finding we need to stay open to 5:30, we'll change it. So the first sort of month, we're going to just see what the demand is till we settle our hours.
And you're open every day, presumably?
Every day, Monday to Saturday, Monday to Sunday.
And you've got a big kitchen here, and I know that some people really quite found that quite attractive and did pop-ups, really, because of the usefulness of the kitchen. Can you foresee pop-ups here?
Oh, definitely. You know, to me, the more you use it and the more social it becomes, the better for everybody and the better for Cambridge. We are part of Eat Cambridge, so we're doing a pop-up then to do with making paella, which I think will be quite fun. So that'll definitely
be a sort of a workshop.
Going to be with Romano's, who people know around Cambridge. So she's going to pop in and do a lovely paella for everybody, and everybody has a hand in making it, and then you eat it at the end. So I think that's going to be a lot of fun. So it'll be a start of things to come, maybe.
Right. There's more competition in Cambridge than in Bourne, the Bourne area, I suppose. So do you feel any anxiety about that?
No, I think we've done our research. And it was actually a friend of mine said the other day that she came into Cambridge and she didn't have anywhere to go for a nice homemade slice of cake. So that made me realise that actually if you look around, there are a lot of eateries, but there aren't as many independents as you think. If you really analyse it all, and down this way, there's three, but each one has a different purpose. You've got one that's completely vegan, you've got one that's more art and student based, and we want to be really family and homemade food.
Yeah.
So we try not to have fancy food. We just want really good. Our ethos has always been: we don't have a chef. We have mums in our kitchens, so it's mum's food really that's going on your plate.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Wendy, and good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Well, with flour coming from Stir Cambridge, Abantu has such a good reputation in Bourne, and they're a great name to slot into the Cambridge community.
Yeah. I was there yesterday, actually, because they did a soft opening starting on Tuesday. I was there yesterday.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of people there. And obviously, there were people in there who were obviously fans of Abantu, because Wendy was chatting with people. And it was good, and you can see it's just going to be really popular. So a great addition to the Cambridge cafe scene. Shame Sicky Beaks have gone, but it's nice that they've been replaced by somebody equally good.
Yeah. I'm free. I'm free. God, do you remember that music? That is our music for news of free food available now in Cambridge, which you can find on the Olio app.
Yes, the Olio app, which is free to download, can now also be used on desktops as well. Actually, these are slightly out of Cambridge, but anyway. In Streatham, there is a bag of mini pears, best before the 6th of February, available. You can pick it up on Sunday or on weekday evenings. And also from the same source, 4 tins of Heinz beans with no sugar added. I think in Soham, water kefir grains for making your own probiotic drinks are available. And then Hills Road near Rathmore Road, some kombucha SCOBY, which you can pick up in town most days. And a non-food item, Emily from Huntingdon Road, has a small glass jug. If you're interested in any of those or any other free stuff, then you ought to download and check out the Olio app.
Lovely. And at the end of today's programme, we'll have our usual news roundup, but we thought that today, really because there's so much of it, we'd have a bit here now, in the middle of the programme. So we're going to focus entirely on what's coming up at the Cambridge Science Festival. The programme is now available, and bookings begin on the 12th of February. So, Alan, you've been having a look at what's going on.
Yeah, I've had a quick whiz through, so there might be a few things that I've missed, but the sorts of things that I think would be of interest on the 15th of March... Making Sense of a Healthy Lifestyle, how should we eat and exercise? And it talks about it's a talk about nutrition and exercise and how they're paramount for improving health and preventing disease. But controversy exists over what constitutes a healthy diet.
Mm.
I mean, it's highly controversial. And actually, there's a lot of stuff spoken about it, which I think it's wrong, but anyway. So, for example, people say chocolate is good now and butter is back. So the person there, Alexander Mock from the MRC Epidemiology Unit, is going to try and demystify the research. So that's one. I'm not going to be able to get through all of these. Here's one that really appeals to me greatly. It's called Brewing a Taste for Stem Cells. Explore the science of beer. Cambridge Brewers Moonshine discuss the parallels with life in the laboratory in an interactive talk and beer tasting. And that's on the 15th of March. Actually, the last one was on the 15th of March as well. Yes. So you can't go to both of them. So I think for the next flavour, we'll go and talk to Mark Watts from Moonshine Brewery and find out a little bit about what that's all about. Well, there's one here I've marked, which is actually about the use and abuse of statistics in the media, but that's nothing to do with food. That's just my little obsession, or one of them. Turning the page. On 20th of March, The Science of Fat. For three decades, Professor Stephen O'Reilly of the Metabolic Research Laboratories has been studying why some people are predisposed to developing obesity and or type 2 diabetes when others are not, and how this information can help guide treatment and prevention of the disease. We've got time just maybe for one or two more. 21st of March, The Amazing World of Bees and How Much of the Food We Eat is Thanks to Pollinators. So there's stuff about bees. The 22nd of March, Are Food Miles Worth Worrying About? Well, actually, yes, they are, but I'm sure it'll be an they'll say rather more than that. Finally, I'll be quiet after this. On the 24th of March, there's the Science Festival Dinner at Leckhampton House at part of Corpus Christi's College's postgraduate accommodation. And there's a menu here, which I won't read out. But anyway, the Cambridge Science Festival starts on the 12th of March, and bookings, as Matt said earlier, are on, and I've forgotten when, but quite soon.
Yes, yeah, 12th of February.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Now, a little later in today's programme, Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments will be along with the second part of his advice for people new to growing their own produce. He'll be focusing particularly on planning. But what about some advice on what to grow? If you go into a garden centre, you'll be faced with rack after rack of seeds. How do you choose? Well, last Sunday at the annual Seedy Sunday in Trumpington, Alan came across Dan Warner, who was selling seeds from Thomas Etty, and they are a supplier of heritage seeds.
We specialise in heritage rare and unusual varieties, so tomatoes that actually taste of something. You know, we tend to find that if a variety's been going for 100, 150 years, it's got something going for it, and that's usually the flavour rather than everything being the same size and all coming ripe at exactly the same time.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mentioned tomatoes. So sort of my great project in life is to find tomatoes that do taste of something.
So yes.
Where I've been going wrong is not using heritage seeds, by the sound.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the amount of people we have who sort of say, oh, my grandfather used to grow these, I've never had a tomato like it. You know, it really, it's nice to be able to sort of provide people with that and yeah. to get that back.
Well, give us the name of a couple of varieties of tomato that you sell that you particularly recommend.
The ones we have, some of the ones we have with us today, things like the Black Russian is one that all. We actually started selling because of the amount of people who were coming up and asking after it and just saying, oh, I've never had a tomato. It's been absolutely fantastic. The pink Brandywine tomato, again, is another one that's been going for at least 60 years now, I think. And it's an old Amish variety. And it always comes up, trumps in all the taste tests. You
right.
know,
Black Russian sounds like it originated in Russia.
I think so, yeah. Sort of, I think sort of around the Crimea, I think a lot of tomatoes okay. come through. From.
But, I mean, our climate is okay for it to ripen, or does it...
Oh, yeah, no, a lot of them. Most of what we sell... absolutely fine in this kind of climate. You know, if you can give it a good greenhouse, so much the better, but they're all pretty hardy.
Yeah. Okay, tell me something else that you've got other than tomatoes.
So, I mean, we go back, the oldest variety we have with us today, I think, is the Painted Lady Runner Bean, which dates back to 1633. That variety was introduced, and it's a lovely runner bean. It's rather than most runner beans where you just have the red flowers, this has got white and red flowers on the plant, so it looks really stunning in the garden. It's a lovely looking bean.
Yeah, right. And presumably it tastes good too.
Yes, yeah, no, very good. Very good on taste as well.
Yeah, right, okay. Another one?
Something like the Jersey tree cabbage, which I was talking to someone about earlier today, and I've certainly seen it. The stalk grows to at least 6 foot. According to our packet on the front of it, from the description from 1827, they talk about it growing to 12 or 16 foot. I'm not entirely sure how much of that is artistic license, but I like to think of the cabbages towering above us all.
Right, so you just trim the leaves off, presumably?
Yes, yeah, and they use the they dry out the branches, the stems of it, to use as walking sticks.
Oh, amazing. Right, okay. Anything else you'd particularly pull out?
Another good one we have is the Spanish black carrot, which grows particularly well in the soil around here. We've always been asked specifically by the organisers to bring it along with us because it grows so well around here. And again, it's a beautiful looking carrot. It has a yellow core to it, but the outside is a real deep purple colour. So if you're slicing it up and putting it into salads, it just looks absolutely beautiful. It's one of our best sellers. It really, you know, right. It really sells.
Any idea how long that goes back, when it dates from?
That one... Again, I think it's probably about 70 to 80 years at least, I think, one we've been going for, yeah.
Right, OK. Now, for people who didn't come to CD Sunday in Trumpington, how can they get hold of your products?
We're available online. We have our website is www.thomasetti.co.uk, and that has a copy of our full range, which I think now runs to well over 500 varieties of heritage rare and unusual vegetable seeds. We also are able to supply culinary and medicinal herbs, cottage garden flowers, and British wildflowers as well. So something for everyone. We're also on Twitter at Thomas Etty.
Good. And are they expensive?
They generally work out somewhere around £2 a packet. We're selling them today for £2 a packet. They vary slightly in the catalogue, but today at the sales we tend to make them £2 a packet because it keeps it a lot simpler for everyone involved.
I'm sure it does. Right, all I have to do now is to decide which ones I'm going to try.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Did you buy any of them, Alan?
Well, I did. I bought some tomatoes because, you know, I want some really nice tasty tomatoes.
Yes, yes.
And I was just so entranced by what he said about the Jersey tree cabbage, which grows, who knows, you know, up to 16 feet high. And I just thought that just sounded amazing. So I'm sure mine won't grow anything like that. In fact, might not grow at all.
And, of course, that music signals time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Well, it's been a quiet day for tweets.
It has, yeah.
The weather has an impact on people desiring to tweet. But we have heard from the Devonshire Arms, and they've got a new beer, Edwin Taylor Stout, that's what it is.
Oh, the B&T.
That's the one.
Yes. You
know your beers.
I've heard it. And as promised earlier, here is Dave Fox with some advice on how to go about planning your vegetable garden so that you can get the most from it.
I suppose as you develop your garden, your vegetable plot, you need to remember what you've done before, you need to where you've grown it, you need to know what you're going to do
absolutely,
in the future.
Absolutely, because
so you need to keep a record, don't you?
You do, because you can't rely on remembering it all, and you want to learn from your mistakes. And because gardening happens over quite a long time scale, something you do 1 year might cause a crop loss or some other failure the following year. So you want to be able to have a look back and learn from your mistakes in that way.
So, okay, so how do we go about?
Well, I've got four examples here, and the first is dated. Starts March 25th, 1924. So this is my grandfather's allotment diary. This is a prized possession. And amongst recipes for various fertilisers and poisons for beetles and other things, he's got his lists of seeds. So we can see that in 1933 he bought one stone of early seed potatoes for 6 old pence. And then a list of dates. So what's this? So April 14th, or Good Friday, 7 rows of Sharps Express from Scotland, top garden. So what that means is he's sowing seed potatoes, a variety of Sharp Express, and the potatoes, seed potatoes, as now, come from Scotland. Because they're grown, have we talked about this before, because they're grown in an area which is free from the you know, the insects that spread the viral vector spread disease. And he put that in his top garden. He had two, like me, my grandfather had two allotments, although he made the mistake of having allotments a mile apart, so it was a lot of work. I've got mine adjacent, so I think I'm one up on Grandad there. Anyway, it's a charming record, written, of course, in ink, handwritten with all the varieties, some varieties are still going, and some are not available, but... as I say, it's a prized possession.
Yes, it's lovely.
Yeah, 1934. Yeah. He brought up seven children on the produce of his two allotments. So, you know, keeping a good record was very important to him. Mm. 1936, 37, of course, what I'd love to do is actually analyse this properly and see...
And now if, into the war years.
Yeah, so yeah. What I'd like to see is did he change? Did he grow more? Did he grow more of what was recommended by the government's Dig for Victory campaign and grow less of the other things? Did he actually change his habit? I rather suspect not, because he was a stubborn old boy. But
and he was getting on by then.
He kept going until 1961. Right. Oh, you can see, unfortunately, his writing was really starting to go to pieces here, and I don't think he... really got on too well with the introduction of the biro. Yeah, he's still sowing kidney beans, Dr. McIntosh potatoes. Wonder what they were.
I've never heard of those.
Yeah, broad bean. Oh, it's 1962. Oh, I hadn't noticed that before. 1962. He did another season. Anyway, that's Grandad's allotment diary. When I started doing my allotment, I used this wonderful little book called The Vegetable Jotter by Dr. D. G. Hussain. And that the current version of this is actually called The Vegetable Notebook, but this is highly recommended just because it's a information dense handbook with very easy to use pictures and charts showing you how to grow each crop. So for example, here, marrow, squash and pumpkin, all on the same page, because the cultivation is basically the same.
A really good diagram showing things like spacing and depth of planting and so on.
Absolutely, it's what every beginner asks. So put things in at that spacing and they'll be about right. He's got some recommended varieties and he's got a little calendar showing you when you can sow them and when you expect to harvest. And he does that for every crop, so you can just
flick through to a page. So as you say, it's pretty dense.
Absolutely, yeah. And also, importantly, it's got a plan of your plot subdivided into squares, a grid, thank you, Anna. And this is what I used for my 1997 season.
So it's showing where you planted what.
And when I planted them.
Right.
So I would have been able to use this the following season as the basis for my first rotation to make sure that I didn't repeat. Very useful, that. I mean, if you don't have the book, what you can do is just get here's a pad. This is just a squared pad. I've drawn on that a simple plan of where my beds are. This is to scale, so I've measured my plot out at one long pace for a metre, and then one centimetre square representing a metre, so it's a 1 to 100 scale plan. And on that, one can mark what you're growing where. Even better, draw the outline of all the beds, photocopy it several times, and then you can use those copies for subsequent years and put them in a little ring binder, and then you can flick through and check your rotation
whether deliberately or not, but there's a margin down the side where you can write notes that maybe a crop failed or
didn't. That's handy, isn't it? Wasn't planned, but yeah, absolutely, yeah. So that's what you want. So a paper format where you can write in pencil, rub things out, make notes, refer back to, put it in a ring binder, that's a pretty good way of keeping a record. In 2010, I gave up with this paper-based system because I found that actually a spreadsheet was an even better way to do it. So nowadays I keep my record on this spreadsheet, which shows my bed system and a record going back 7 years now. It has the record of what I planted in each bed. And then we're currently in this column, which is winter 2018. And that shows, for example, that I've got broad beans growing in bed A4. And they were in bed A5 adjacent to that the year before.
Oh.
So I can easily do my rotation from there. And also in each cell of the spreadsheet, I can put little notes. So this is probably the most extensive note I've ever written, actually. This is the sweet corn bed from this summer, which documents not merely what I planted and when, and where I got the seed from and so on, but also my various attempts to keep the sodding badgers
out. Yes, I see. The 1st of September, badgers got in through low hole where pallet broken.
Planning, it does take a little bit of time. The spreadsheet's a little bit fiddly. I know it's not for everyone, but I think a few hours spent at the computer during the winter does really allow savings of some time when you're actually out in the garden.
That's fantastic.
I'm obsessive as well.
I'm not sure that I would ever get that far. But
my spreadsheet, I can view that on my mobile phone. So for me, that does the job as well, because it at least it tells me what I'm trying to grow where. Mm. The actual details of how to grow it, I have to get that from a different source. So for that, I would go to a website such as Garden Organic.
Right.
And they have some excellent information. Another good website is gardenfocused.co.uk. I don't know much about it, but it's really good because you can configure it to your own locality, so it'll automatically adjust the sowing and planting times to approximate to your own district. And it also seems to be very well written. And of course, the RHS website.
Mm.
As for books, I'd recommend anything by Dr. Hussain, I mentioned earlier, just he's the fruit expert, another one in his series. There's 30 or 40 of these. Just because the information is just so well organised.
You always see these on sale at garden centres, don't
well,
you?
Well, rightly so, yeah. I mean, yeah. He must have cornered the market. I mean, I don't agree with everything he says, because he does recommend using herbicides and pesticides that I wouldn't want to use. So, but you can ignore those bits and use all the good stuff. Another book. Now, if you want to make a forest garden where we're going to build a system of perennials, which is something like a young native woodland that are heavily tweaked for human food production. This book, How to Make a Forest Garden by Patrick Whitefield. This is wonderful. A great teacher who sadly died a couple of years ago or so. And this is a very practical guide to how to design your forest garden. Lots of information about tree types, spacings, how you might choose a selection of fruits to crop throughout the year. And the last book I wanted to mention, this is very old, this is called Grow Your Own Fruit and Vegetables by Lawrence D. Hills. And he is the chap who founded the Henry Doubleday Research Association, which is now called Garden Organic. This version is copyright 1971. Mm. And it's a hilarious read. There's lots of pictures. A lot of the things in here I wouldn't necessarily follow. here's a little machine he builds out of cotton reels and lolly sticks for getting rid of flea beetle or something. The guy is absolutely obsessed, a man after my own heart, really opinionated. So if you want to have a good laugh and learn a bit about gardening, that's a good one to seek out.
Right, presumably not on sale anymore, so a library might have a copy.
Yeah, well, I found this one secondhand. I mean, I think what I found is about gardening books is that most of them are out of date almost as soon as they're printed, because it seems that our seasons are getting a bit longer, a bit more unpredictable. We're having these long, dry springs. We had one year, not 2012, was wet all the time. Mm. There was only like one dry week in the whole year. And then, so we're having extreme weather patterns. But I think that means perhaps our sowing windows are getting a bit longer, actually. We can probably start sowing a bit earlier and hope for crops to keep going a bit longer. But we might need to be a bit more adaptable and think about being ready to protect crops from extreme weather events and so on. So that's why I tend to go to online resources rather than books these days. Mm.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dave.
Pleasure.
And the books that Dave mentioned there were Anything on the Subject by D.G. Hussain and How to Make a Forest Garden by Patrick Whitefield.
Yeah, that last book I hadn't seen before, and I must say it is extremely good.
Now, in our next feature, I met up with Hal Wilson. Hal, as you may know, is the co-owner of Cambridge Wine Merchants. He also brought along a new voice in Emily Beauvais, and she's been with the Wine Merchants for, I think, a little bit less than a year. This feature is about the Burgundy region in France, and it's a rather topical one, this, addressing the frost that blighted the area and the impact on their wines since then.
So today we're going to be talking about the great Burgundy vintage of 2016, but also what was really special about that vintage was that it was very small. They had very bizarre weather conditions, And in 2017, the rest of the world also suffered frost and drought and rain and rot and all sorts of things that winemakers don't like. On the upside, let's talk about the great quality in Burgundy in 2016. So, there's a bit of a tradition in the UK that the second week of January is a time to think about the wines from the Burgundy region. Burgundy is the spiritual home of Chardonnay as a white wine and Pinot Noir as a red wine, which are both great varieties that like cool conditions and are both quite temperamental, particularly Pinot Noir. It needs just the right conditions, not too hot, not too cold. It's our Goldilocks variety, but one that we all love.
Oh yes, I love Burgundy. It's one of my favourite regions in France.
And so that means that somebody has got to go and find the unknown jewels in Burgundy. And that means jumping in a car in that second week of January, driving down to Burgundy, knocking on doors and tasting the new wine. It's quite cold in Burgundy, but it's very atmospheric because you arrive and the vignerons, the people working in the vines, are coming back to work and they are pruning. And when they prune, they have these little fires in wheelbarrows, little furnaces that they take along. And so you get these plumes of smoke drifting up over this very famous slopes of the Côte de Beaune and the Côte de Nuit. And so this year, Alice and I went on a sort of four-day trip to the Beaune region, the Côte de Nuit region. But in 2016, they had all sorts of trouble, mostly because there were some very cold winds in the end of April. And you think of the spring being nice and warm and the vine starting to push out leaves and buds. If you have a really cold wind coming down the valleys there, that turns them pretty much to sort of tobacco leaves. They kind of desiccate and you lose an awful lot of your potential harvest. And that's what happened in the sort of 25th and 26th of April 2016. Fortunately, we'd done our research and there are a few places that had not suffered at all from frost. The really terrible thing was talking to people who had really devastating yields. If they lost 80% of their harvest, what are they to do with the remaining 20? The upside was that the fruit that everybody did harvest was really good quality. And so we were delighted with the wines that we were trying, both from barrel or just bottled. And we're trying whites and reds. And really, we'd never come across wines that were so enjoyable to drink at such a young stage. Wines that are young tend to be quite firm in their tannins, so they're bitter or they also have higher acidity to sort of feel. And so you're feeling either something that's really sharp or something that's quite bitter. And you have to predict how that's going to develop over time. But what we found was there was this beautiful balance of all the things you want, of fruit ripeness, of acidity, of ripe tannins, and concentration in the wines in moderation, all beautifully balanced. And we came back with a bootload of wines to taste with customers, particularly university customers, but also private clients, and with our staff. I think, Emily, you had some favourites from what we brought back.
Oh, yes, I tasted some of them, and you had one from Bachelet Le Gros, a very good producer. I tried this Santonnet Premier Cru, the red wine, Clos Rousseau. Very nice wine. It was awesome. Meursault as well.
Sylvain Doussard.
That was the two favorites. The good thing with Bachelet Le Gros, in Burgundy, like I told you, you've got climat, so the terroir, and you've got clos as well. Clos is like a terroir surrounded by wall, like Clos Vougeot, for example. So just to give you an idea, Clos Vougeot, you've got at least 80 owners, like 80 different owners, so it's quite a lot. But for Clos Rousseau, it's only Bachelet Le Gros owning the Clos Rousseau, and I think it's wonderful that you can taste the wine only from this terroir and from this producer, so I really enjoy this wine a lot.
And the really special thing about that particular vineyard is that the vines were planted by Samuel's great-great-grandfather in 1914. Now that is really old. Think of vine age in terms of human age. They're getting pretty serious when they're 40 to 50 years old. They can be called old vines. When they're 103 years old, they deserve real respect. But this vineyard is in really great condition, producing wonderfully rich fruit, which seems to get richer as the vines get older. There's a bit of some miracle of nature there, but there's some physics as well with the roots of the vine system going ever deeper into the soil to be able to bring up nutrients and find water, so that those vines are more protected from extremes of hot and cold. They're probably more rot resistant, they're more mildew and pest resistant as well, somehow, which is a lovely thing about studying and loving wine and making wine. There are things that we know and there are things that we don't know. So there's a bit of mystery and a bit of art involved in winemaking and tasting. So we've got a wine to taste from our trip, but also a wine which is already in our shops in Cambridge Wine Merchants. And this is from the Mâcon region. And the village the vineyards come from is called Montagny. And this is a premier cru. So Emily earlier was talking about the climat. This is the way that the French have decided which are the best vineyards in the area. So they have a classification pyramid. The biggest part of the triangle will be just Bourgogne. Bourgogne Rouge, Bourgogne Blanc. That can come from anywhere in an area, from Chablis in the north to the Mâcon and Beaujolais in the south. So you've got quite a big area. Bourgogne Blanc, Bourgogne Rouge. It will still be made from Chardonnay and Pinot Noir mainly. Then you've got the village. So we've got Montagny as the village here. Then you have Premier Cru, some of the best sites in the area. These are first growth sites. And then at the very top, you have Grand Cru. And those are very expensive and sort of very sought after wines, and there's hardly any made. So it's quite different from Bordeaux, where you'll have millions of bottles. So Grand Cru in Burgundy is particularly rare and special. Premier Cru is also really good. So this one is Montagny Premier Cru, but at £15 a bottle is not going to break the bank. This is an affordable Premier Cru. So this is Chardonnay. This is a white wine, with some of the wine being aged in barrel.
Very nice wine, very fruity on the nose. You can smell lemon, grapefruit, minerality a little bit at the end as well. Very fresh. So to start with that as an appetizer, because it's quite light, it can be a nice idea because you've got the fruit, it's a light wine. So you can start with this wine, very good and easy. And I would even drink it with fish, of course. So nice fish, like, for example, a sea bass in English.
Bar in French?
Is it the bar? Yes. Yeah.
Or papillote, maybe, with some lemon or something?
Yeah, exactly.
With something with a bit of lemony character.
My mom is doing a perfect dish with gravy, but it's the same, like you said. It's in a crepe, sea bass, some lemon, and some nice fish sauce on. Would go perfectly with this wine, I think.
We'll have most of these wines available by the spring onwards, which we recommend wholeheartedly from the 2016 vintage.
Yeah, I find it quite shocking to think that just those 2 days can render so much damage.
Me too. I mean, it is devastating if you have the wrong weather at the wrong time. I remember being in Bordeaux last April. It was 75 degrees in old money. You know, it was absolutely beautiful. We were going around tasting lots of wines, very different from the Burgundy experience where you're not taking off your jacket this time. It was T-shirt weather. And a couple of weeks later, plunging temperatures everywhere. We had the same in the UK. And so it's affected English vineyards as well. But on the 25th, 26th, temperatures got down to -7 degrees and really didn't get above that in certain vineyard areas for 72 hours. So it was sub-zero and well below zero. And when you've got vines that are already got the sap rising, they've got lots of leaves, and those leaves are very sort of fragile at that time, then they just desiccate. They can't cope, and that means that they don't produce the flowers, which then produce most of the harvest. What happens is that they hope that the temperatures recover and that the vine actually produces a secondary flowering, but that flowering will be a lot less, a lot smaller, and also a little bit problematic in terms of ripening. So it's very scary. Not every area and every vineyard was affected with horrible frost, but the temperatures in certain areas got to low temperatures. Some sites are a little bit higher than where the frost is collecting, or a little bit lower, or protected by a hillside or a wood. And you'll see vineyards actually planted below woods or below cliffs in order to protect them. And you'll see different ways the vigneron from the perils of frost, because it is a real peril. So 2017 was a very interesting vintage all around the world. I've seen some statistics that in terms of global wine production compared to the year before, 2016, in 2017 the world lost out on the equivalent of the entire production of Australia and South Africa. That's how much less wine was made in 2017 than 2016. That doesn't mean that the quality is bad, and often what you find in smaller vintages is higher quality. But what really created the conditions was, in Europe, a very late frost again. I was talking about that in Burgundy in 2016. The rest of Europe, from Rioja, Bordeaux, the Loire Valley, northern Italy, Germany, all of these places suffered deep frosts in late April, the worst possible time. Follow that up with rain at the wrong time, droughts, then you have a real issue. One bright point, if you like Eastern European wines, is that Romania produced 61% more wine than in 2016. And I think we can probably see good quality, inexpensive wines, maybe from Pinot Grigio and Pinot Noir, coming onto the market in greater quantities in supermarkets and wine merchants from Romania. It's pretty much the only thing that we can hold out a celebratory armour. It does mean that even if there's good quality with reduced prices, it's quite possible that you'll see price rises wherever you're shopping for wine. I think we have already great value selection of wines and the greatest range of wines available to us in the world, here in the UK, even here in Cambridge. But we're experiencing a lot of price increases. Exchange rates are turbulent. And after the referendum vote, the pound has been worth a lot less against most wine-producing countries' currencies. So there is some good news in terms of quality. There is also the prospect that we might need to drink a little bit better and a little bit less this year.
And that was Hal Wilson of the Cambridge Wine Merchants. No Alice Archer this time round, as she's just jetted off to help Murray Barlow at the Rustenburg Estate in Stellenbosch, South Africa, to help with the vintage for a couple of months.
Yeah, and before she left, she won two really prestigious awards from the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. These are courses that are run at the Cambridge Wine Merchants branches. The first one was for very best practical exam in blind tasting. That was very scary and very hard, according to Hal. And Alice came out with the best in the world out of many thousands of students.
Oh, that's fantastic. And yeah, she got very high marks in her theory exam as well.
So congratulations,
congratulations
Alice.
We also hope she's okay, because there is a colossal drought in South Africa at the moment in the Cape Town and Stellenbosch area, the worst in a century, and they can't predict when the drought is going to break. So she's out in the vineyards where it's baking hot, and she's... Well, we've had the frost in Burgundy with Hal, and when Alice returns, perhaps she'll be able to tell us about the drought in Stellenbosch. Mm. And the green onions theme leads us into the Cambridge food and drink news, starting as usual with jobs. Trinity in Trinity Lane is looking for a chef de partie. Phone Cambridge 351 880 for details.
And as we said earlier in the programme, a Bantu has opened in Hobson Street, and also newly reopened is the Three Horseshoes in Maddingley, now run by Cam's Cuisine. Some very appealing things on the menu, starters like fig and goat's cheese tart, game tureen. Mains include steak and wild mushroom suet pudding, just the job for winter. And there are a couple of vegetarian options and a fish board too.
Market news now. On Saturdays on Ely Market, Hum Closen now have a new cheese. It's called Dapple. It's a cheddar style made from unpasteurised cow's milk from a small herd in Binham, Norfolk. And on Cambridge Sunday Market, Hawthorne Farms are now selling smoked chicken rashers and breasts.
Rockers in Mill Road has closed, but it is still there on the Cambridge Leisure Park in Clifton Way. In its place will come a branch of Kebabish Original, a takeaway kebab franchise, which doesn't appeal to me, but anyway.
On the 9th of February at the Edge Cafe, that's 351 Mill Road, there is What a Waste. Now, this is an evening of short films and talks exploring food waste, its impacts and community solutions. It's free admission, but it might be wise to book via the Edge website.
Also on the 9th of February, Provenance Kitchen Pitch-Up at Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street.
And the 10th of February marks the reopening of Kettle's Yard after its extensive building works, and they're going to reopen with a cafe that's being run by the Garden Cafe of Botanic Garden and Mill Road fame.
There are several special Valentine events coming up. Jamie Burton of Squire's Kitchen has a Valentine's pop-up at Fitzbillies in Trumpington Street on, yes, the 14th of February. There's a vegetarian menu and an omnivore's menu, both with six courses and both £45. Book from at SquireChef85 on Twitter or Instagram.
Also for Valentine's Day, there is a special menu at Navadanya for £65 per person and with a flight of wine for £21.50. One of the dishes that caught my eye was deep-fried spiced purple potatoes with ginger, cumin and lime leaf. Delicious.
Yes. K-Rico Tapas are doing a delivery to your home of a special boxed meal which you can microwave for a Valentine's Day in your own house. There are four menus to choose from. The price is £41.98 per person, and you get a bottle of Carver to go with it. Delivery is for CB1 to 5 only, and it's available from the 14th to the 17th of February. Details are on the K-Rico Tapas website.
And on the subject of Valentine's Day, there is a very enticing menu at Maurizio's in Mill Road. You can check out full details of that on their website.
Yes, and it does look good. Looking well ahead, Restaurant 22 reopens on the 24th of March under new ownership with Sam Carter. Bookings are now being taken on their website.
And that's all we have time for today. If you've missed bits or you'd just like to hear the whole thing over again, well, there's a podcast early next week.
And if you'd like to get in touch with any news or comment when we're off the air, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.co.uk or contact us on Twitter @flavour105.
We'll be back on the 17th of February. Thanks for listening.
Goodbye. Bye.